It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to. Lots to talk about. Interesting couple of days. Interesting couple of days of reevaluating the last election, reevaluating some of the big wins last week on the infrastructure front. Just kind of in this moment where people have been vacillating between, well, you know, Tuesday was, you know, historic timing, happens every time around. This is an off-year election. All of those excuses. And then my position of, well, Dems deserved a little shellacking. They deserved a wake-up call. They deserved something to get them moving because they didn't produce. Ultimately, that's it. Now, I'm man enough to say that, you know what, it's probably both. It's historic. This happens all the time. We knew what was going to come. We knew it was going to be uphill. But the failures of Dems to produce and also to connect with workers, that's been the part here. And I've been saying for the last week, Democratic politicians, find a picket line. Find a worker who's on strike. Spend a day with them. Walk with them. Talk with them. Understand what they're going through. Hear them. Learn from them. Master's course in working class economics. Walk that picket line. And I would say that to every person. Get out there and find out what exactly these people are fighting for. They are fighting for that American dream. That better tomorrow, that future for their kids, that life that we were told that if you worked hard, you played by the rules, you would get ahead. That's what you're going to hear. Not all of the divisive stuff. You know, if you're the mayor of Wokistan, find your way to a picket line. Listen to somebody else for a change. Stop bloviating. Get out there and go, you know what? How can we do something together? How can we find the common ground to move in a positive direction? How can we do that? Because here's the reality. Very clearly, very simple. The working class of this country is the largest multicultural coalition on the planet. When we start talking about how do we make our lives better, and this is something I've been saying for years, this isn't new. There's nothing new here. There's people who've listened to this show for the 16 years I've been doing it. You know, nothing new here. This is where I've been preaching. This is the pulpit. This is the message. This is the holy gospel according to me. The reality is if we make people's lives better, all that other stuff, everything else, we can work through. When people can feed their kids, when they don't have to worry about if there's going to be a roof over the kids' head, when they can start preparing for tomorrow, and they feel they have some pride and dignity in the workplace, and there's opportunity, lots of good things happen. Now, if you continue down the path where people are struggling and all of the things that we see, you get chaos because people are looking, they're looking for something, someone to fight for them. And I got to tell you, I don't know why the Democratic Party isn't right now, because you know they're not doing anything in the House. They've been recessed. How come they're not at every picket line in this country just grabbing a hold of someone? It's amazing to me. And look, here's the thing. Had if Trump was useful for anything, if he should have been useful for anything, it should have been the fact that he rung the bell of reality for the Democratic Party that you've lost the blue-collar voter. And I'm not saying white, black, Hispanic. You have lost the white collar voter, and you need to get it back. And what's interesting to me, I had a bunch of people email me, "Hey, did you see this In These Times story? You know about what you're talking about? You know, lost jobs, lost Democrats. Have you seen this Politico article? You know why Democrats keep losing rural counties like mine? A new report out, Factory Town, written by a guy named Richard Martin. for the American family voices and 21st century Democrats. And all of this stuff is like, oh my gosh, we've discovered something. And you go, no, Magellan, you haven't discovered anything. You are right where we were years ago. You were right where I was talking about in 2011 as Scott Walker was sticking it to working people in Wisconsin. In 12, when Snyder and Michigan were passing right to work. In states across this country where working people have been under attack. Their standard of living has been under attack. I've been saying, look, you gotta stop this. You got to do something. And understand, there is not a Democratic chairperson in any rural county in this country who's going to tell you anything differently than I'm going to say right now. They already know what the problem in rural America is. And that's, well, the Democratic Party has abandoned working people and their unions for years. That has happened. Clinton and the DLC Democrats back in the 90s, horrible trade policies because, hey, you don't need those dirty factory jobs. We're going to get you an education and then you'll have a good life. Well, how's that been working out? How's that been working out? I mean, I sat 20 feet from Barack Obama when he said, you can trust me. We're not going to pass Corus, Panama, Colombia. Not going to do it. And what'd we get? Panama, Corus, Colombia. And wanted to pass the TPP. More bad trade deals, more job losses. And understand, we've lost millions of manufacturing jobs in small towns across this country. The small and mid-sized manufacturing jobs, most of them are gone. But those are the ones we were told back in the 80s and 90s that, hey, we're gonna get rid of those. We're all going to get office jobs. We're all going to get corner offices, wear suits and ties. Well, here's the thing. The vast majority of people I know don't want that. They were happy doing their factory job. They were happy with the job that they were able to take raw materials and actually build something with their bare hands. And now we're in this moment of kind of a brain drain where those manufacturing jobs, they're not there anymore. And those communities have been left behind for, well, more than a decade now. And what's replaced them? Family Dollar. What's replaced them? Hawking things on eBay. What's replaced those solid wage union factory jobs? Hoping you can get a freelance gig, maybe driving for Uber? Because now you're your own boss, but your life is worse. And this is where I keep coming back to. The message in this is simple. Whatever your issue is, whatever silo you're in on the Democratic Party, you need to right now reach out to a working person. Find a picket line in your neighborhood and walk with somebody for a day. And don't say a word. Just listen. I know that's hard for us in this day and age. It's hard to listen to other people's concerns. But this is that moment where, as I said, we, the working class of this country, is the largest, without question. The largest multicultural, multiracial, multigender, multi-everything coalition on this planet. If we can get people to come together and say, you know what? Everyone should earn a living wage. Everyone should have retirement security. Everyone should have health security. Everyone should not have to work more than 8 or 10 hours a day. Everyone should have a weekend and vacation and paid leave and an opportunity at the life that we were sold as children. The idea that we're Americans, it's our birthright to live that American dream. The little house, the white picket fence, the dog, the 2.3 kids, the car, the driveway, vacations, retirement security, all of that. It's what we were sold. I mean, we've screwed a couple of generations already. The millennials are screwed over because of these bad policies. And then generations after them, well, why do you think we are where we are? Because people are looking, they're looking for someone who's going to fight for them, anyone. And you look at the numbers, and this Richard Martin guy does a really good job of going through what once were the Democratic strongholds. Places like Iowa, Illinois, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Ohio, you know, all of these states where This was where, you know, Democrats had the stronghold because that's where the jobs were. Indiana, Missouri, upstate New York. Good, solid, medium-sized companies who paid a living wage and were part of that community. All gone now. And just a hollow shell of what they used to be. And this is where, you know, I'm looking at Biden's agenda and saying, is there a way to reset that, to recreate that? Because we already know what the answer is. We know what the problem is, and we know the answer. And the answer right now is getting things done. You know, I go back to, I started this program 16 years ago. On one hand, to fight back against the right-wing rage machine and their dominance in talk radio. But also partially to keep Democrats in line. You know, they would come to our union hall and make all these promises and then get into office and never do anything. It's time to actually hold everyone accountable. Wouldn't it be great if you know, both political parties said, you know what? Maybe we do need to have workers with rights on the job. Maybe we do need people who to make it earn a livable wage. Instead of the political world that we're in. You know, I don't know anyone who looks in any urban or rural setting who says, you know what, we need to punish the other because of just where they're located. You know, I've been through a number of small towns over the years where they had that one factory, that magnet factory, where all of the economic activity sprung out of. It was what made that community, it's what made them. It was their personality. It was everything about it. And now it's gone. Because of bad policy. It wasn't an invisible hand. It wasn't magic. It wasn't, oh, gee, I don't know how that happened. We know how it happened. It was bad policy. And this is where I keep coming back to. You want to change this country? Change the workplace. We start there. We start with the economy. We start with making sure that every person who shows up and gets to work every day earns a reasonable living. And then we fan out from there. And I know we're so used to being in our silos, throwing bombs at each other and tearing each other apart that's impossible. But that's the way forward. And I know we don't have that kind of sense much anymore. But for once, maybe we start thinking about each other instead of just me. And Democrats, you got to get something done. I mean, the reality is there's no healthcare initiative going on. You know, there's some money for the ACA, but you've got a Republican Party hell-bent on destroying that. We didn't get an increase in the minimum wage again. We're now, what, 12? Almost going on 13 years since the last time the minimum wage on the federal level was increased. Student debt relief, we don't have any of that. No paid family leave yet. None of that stuff. But you know what the great part of this is? All of that stuff we can work on. All of that stuff we can build on. Because here's the thing. Here's the amazing part. And I've walked picket lines with Trump supporters and Republicans for years. The dirty little secret? They want those things too. They want a better opportunity for their children. They want a better opportunity for themselves. They want a living wage. They want health care. They want retirement. They want the same stuff. The difference is we've got to change where the narrative is thrown at us. Because the wealth class does a brilliant job of keeping us pitted against each other. Always angry at each other. Like, I saw this story today that just, you know, made me go, I don't know whether I buy it or not. The John Deere strike that's going on, the original tentative agreement was shot down 90%. 90% of the people voted against it. The second time they came back with a little bit better offer, and not a bad offer, it was shot down 55 to 45. Now the headlines, you know, one guy just wants to go back to work. He wants to save everybody. One guy, they won't name who he is, but there's one guy out there. And this is how they play people against each other. Because there's that one guy. He's out there. And that could be you. And they play this to the point to where they really can divide us. You know, the old word solidarity still means something. The old idea of standing shoulder to shoulder and walking towards something together is much better than standing in the street shouting at each other. And with neither of us hearing each other. And that's where the wealth class has got us. That's where we are in this moment. So for me, the hope between now and, you know, just the end of the month is that everyone find a picket line. Take on a worker. In fact, you know, get 10 of your friends to come around, and all 10 of you have that person be your instructor for the day. Maybe bring them lunch. They could use the help. Maybe stand with them and understand why they're where they are and the fight that they're taking on and how difficult it is for them and their family. Because ultimately, if enough workers win, if enough workers go on strike and do the things that are happening right now, living conditions and everything get better. People do better. Seems simple to me. It really does. It seems simple. But in this day and age of I got to score my political points and I've got to throw my bombs and I've got to divide, I would like just for a week, just 1 week, and then we can go back to hating on each other in our silos. I would like Democrats at least and working people find a picket line and walk with that person. Spend a day walking that picket line. Spend a day hearing those stories and understand what it is to walk a mile in their shoes. And I know you're not allowed to talk about that anymore, but it was one of the things that my mother always said: before you judge someone, walk a mile in their shoes. Understand what it is they're going through. Might help indeed. Got lots to get to today. Love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Gonna take a quick break, right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk. There's nothing more American than workers standing up, and the union gives a voice to win on The Rick Smith Show. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1909. That was the day members of the industrial workers of the world began a free speech fight in Spokane, Washington. Wobblies often intersected seasonal workers through street corner soapboxing. Many towns and cities worked to resist IWW organizing efforts by passing ordinances against such rallies. Wobblies challenged these repressive tactics. They would descend on a town or city in great numbers, forcing mass arrests that overwhelmed local authorities and judicial systems. At Spokane, the organizing campaign began a year earlier. Wobblies mobilized against local employment agencies that charged workers fees for jobs that didn't exist. The campaign was so popular that the IWW was able to establish a union hall, hold meetings and lectures, and establish a newspaper. The Spokane City Council quickly passed an ordinance against street corner rallies. When Wobblies learned that religious groups were exempt from the restrictive ordinance, they announced November 2nd as Free Speech Day in Spokane. They put out the call, wanted men to fill the jails of Spokane. By the end of the month, as many as 500 had been arrested. The War Department even offered up nearby Fort Wright to handle the glut of prisoners. A young Elizabeth Gurley Flynn arrived in Spokane to soapbox. Efforts to arrest her were briefly frustrated after she chained herself to a nearby lamppost. Flynn made good use of her time in jail. She reported on appalling prison conditions and accused the local sheriff of operating a brothel out of the women's prison section. The free speech fight gained nationwide attention and enjoyed wide public support. By March, all prisoners were released, the ordinance had been rescinded, and employment agencies' license revoked. The IWW won big.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So some craziness. Again, when you look at the insanity, you've got the Ted Cruz's going after Big Bird. How do you go after Big Bird? Seriously, how do you attack Big Bird? You've got Paul Gosar, the congressman from Arizona, evidently going through an anime slaying of AOC. And you go, does he need an intervention at this moment? Is there something that we can help him with? And this is we're in this such a weird moment where you look at the vote for infrastructure and you got very few Republicans to come on board. It's almost like they're quite happy to allow the country to take a nosedive, and they're quite happy to let things go south and bring us the most insane kind of topics. Really? Big Bird got vaccinated, so now there's an attack? But I guess this is the world in which we now find ourselves. And I come back to blaming us. I come back to blaming we the people. I come back to blaming the people who are voting for these folks. Because understand, this new Jonathan Karl book that's coming out, for instance, tells the story of how Trump's leaving on January 20th. And it's the weirdest kind of thing in that he's saying he's going to leave the party entirely. It's done. And knows it's going to destroy the Republican Party, and he's okay with that. And personally, I'm actually kind of okay with it too, because this is not the grand old party of Reagan. This is not the grand old party of Eisenhower. This ain't your grandparents' Republican Party by any stretch of the imagination. And here to share some thoughts on, well, just how crazy things and how much things have gone off the rail, I've asked Reed Galen to come talk with us. Reed is the co-founder of the Lincoln Project. What you need to know about Reed is he was a former George W. Bush guy and Republican operative for quite a long time. Now the co-founder of the Lincoln Project, and here to share some thoughts on where things are. Reed, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me.
So, I'm looking at this moment, and I'm looking at Big Bird. I'm looking at Gosar's anime slaying of AOC, and I'm going, what the hell is wrong with the GOP?
Well, I mean, Rick, where do we begin? I think first and foremost, you have to remember that the party that I grew up in, literally grew up in Washington, D.C., at least had some semblance of a governing philosophy. It was supposed to be fiscal responsibility, moral and muscular foreign policy, and some sort of, commitment to individual liberty. Now it is all performative. Now it is all about owning the libs and, inciting culture wars where it can. Why does Paul Gosar do that insane anime? Because he knows there will be outrage. Why does Ted Cruz go after Big Bird? Because he knows there will be outrage. There is no greater good at play. There is nothing better than their own self-aggrandizement, ascension to, and retention of power. That's it.
Now, what do you say to this person who says, Reed, that the Democrats do the same thing? This is what our political system sadly has turned into, and there's no hope for democracy left.
Well, I would say this is that, politics is a tough business, as you know. And going back to the beginning of the Republic, right, this American politics has always been a very bare-knuckle sport. But when it came to governing, at least in modern times, most of the time the parties did what was supposed to be done. You think about it was now 50 years ago, 50 some years ago, that Republicans and Democrats came together for the Civil Rights Act, for the Voting Rights Act. In the 1980s, nobody wants to admit this as Republicans. Reagan slashed taxes as soon as he got to office, realized he'd cut too much, spent too much on the military, and raised taxes again. Right. He might have been a supply sider, in a campaign, right, where trickle down economics and all that other silliness. But he understood that, like, the government needed money to run and he didn't want to run into deficits and all that. And now what we see is that there's only two parties in this country, as you know, and only one of them is committed to any sort of small D democratic principles. And that's the big D Democratic Party.
Yeah. And on the Reagan front, he also did something on immigration that we can't seem to get anything done with on this day either.
But Rick, remember, it wasn't just on immigration. It was an amnesty. anybody who was in the country was allowed to stay, right? Like, it was, this was not some grand policy thing. It was a blanket action on his part that, you know, as you know, my guess is that if you held Reagan up as anything other than a mythological figure to most Republicans nowadays, they would decry his actions.
Yeah, no, I've said that he's unrecognizable in today's Republican Party. I've had Republicans tell me, no, no. And I say, well, I lived through that era. I do remember him. I wasn't a huge fan, but he wasn't this. I don't think he was someone who would have defended an insurrection to overthrow our ballot box. I got to think he wouldn't go that far.
Well, let's say this. One, he would never have incited it. And two, I would venture to say that Tip O'Neill, who was then Speaker of the House, never for a million years would have stood up for an Article 2 branch attack on the Article 1 branch, right? It just would never have happened because no one could imagine. Now, you know, Rick, if there's one thing we really have to get through all our heads is that every day when you say it could be, it couldn't get worse, it can get worse. Our biggest threat will be a lack of imagination about how willing these people are to do the things that we could never before have conceived of.
Yeah, see, the difference is I've met Steve Bannon. I do believe that there is no depth deep enough. I do believe there is no there's no well deep enough that he won't dive into. There's nothing that he and his ilk won't do. So I got to tell you, I'm prepared for some pretty ugly.
It's going to be ugly. I mean, Bannon is a really good example of the philosophical belief system of the far right conservative movement in this country and the amorality of it. Remember that Steve Bannon is a self-avowed Leninist, not John Lennon, Vladimir Lenin, right? Who said, you know, if you're going to start something new, you have to burn down the administrative state. And those are the words he uses. He wants to take what this country is. He wants to reduce its foundations to rubble and build it up in some unbelievable nihilistic dark vision that he's conceived of. And unfortunately, whether or not it's Donald Trump or a lot of other Republicans, there seem to be a hell of a lot of people who are willing to follow him down that path.
Yeah, I mean, you look at the party today and I keep coming back to, I blame voters. We voted these people in. These are the choices we're given and we keep making bad ones. Am I wrong? I mean, at some point, do the Republican voters bear any responsibility in how off the rails the party has gone?
You know, I think it's a yin and a yang. Leadership matters, even bad leadership. And I think it is a natural reaction that some folks in the tumult of the last 20 years between 9/11. You know, a technological revolution, an economic meltdown, you know, 20 years of war, you know, all of the pandemic, all of it, right? We're in a very transitional period in history. It does bother me, though, and I say this to a lot of people who I used to consider friends, that so many of them would go along with all of the ugliness and truly bad things for, you know, conservative judges and tax cuts.
Now, today there were a number of names listed for subpoenas. The January 6th commission has come out with a bunch of names. William Stepien, Jason Miller, John Eastman, Michael Flynn, Angela McCollum, and Bernie Kerik. Do these people ever see the inside of a hearing room? I mean, you know, I have some hope, maybe, possibly. But do they ever see anything? I mean, because this whole process is taking way too long, in my view. And what's happened is I think the Republican echo chamber and their media machine has almost rewritten the narrative already to turn those people on January 6th into heroes and martyrs when I see them as criminals and insurrectionists.
I think a lot of it depends on whether or not the Justice Department ultimately issues, a subpoena and orders Steve Bannon to appear or be jailed. I think that there's a lot of folks on that list who have no fear of ever being really brought to justice for anything. You have somebody like a Bill Stepien who came within a razor's, you know, breadth of going to federal prison for the stuff that he did when he worked for Chris Christie in New Jersey and Bridgegate and all that. My guess is that maybe he's someone who would flip because he's already come that close, and my guess is he doesn't, you know, he's not Lazarus when it comes to federal prison. He probably doesn't want to take a second shot at it. But I would say that, you know, the Bernie Carricks of the world, these people have gone truly over the line, and they'll, you know, my guess is that they will say, come and get me. And if and when they are, you know, brought in and, you know, perp walked into a federal courthouse, they will be considered martyrs. So justice must be done. These subpoenas must be honored, but we shouldn't be under any illusion that any of them will come quietly.
No, none of them are going to come quietly. I mean, but if it were you, well, if it were me, I know they would come and drag me in there, and I wouldn't have a choice. But these are folks who have powerful allies and money behind them.
Yeah, and you mentioned one thing about the Republican media machine, and it really has to be encapsulated into the conservative ecosystem. The media machine is part of it, but there is a lot of money, right? There's a lot of judicial philosophy. There's a lot of policymaking, you know, out of places like the Heritage Foundation, right, which is responsible almost single-handedly for writing a lot of this anti-voting legislation we've seen this year. So it is a very highly organized, well-resourced, well-funded, and dedicated movement. One that I got to be honest with you, Rick, I was telling somebody earlier today, even as a young operative, you know, who was lucky enough to work at the White House in my 20s, I think I was either intentionally unaware or blissfully ignorant that stuff, those forces were at work, right? Like, I just didn't understand what was going on. And this is, you know, you don't get to a 6-3 conservative court overnight. That's a 40-year process, right? You don't come up with stuff on like SB 8 in Texas overnight. Somebody spent a lot of time and a lot of resources writing that bill to be as weird and convoluted as it was, so that they thought that it could clear a court challenge. So we should never underestimate that they will continue. They will fight. They will not stop. They will not stop.
No, I mean, there's too much money. The wealth class of this country has bought themselves the best think tanks possible to sit around and dream up bad ideas, so that when crisis hits, they are able to take full advantage of it. And this isn't new. I mean, I think most people don't really understand the kind of network, the state policy network of think tanks that are out there producing bad ideas every day, and the kind of wealth that's spent on a microphone to promote those bad ideas. I think most people that I know just think, well, this is natural. It's grassroots organizing. It's just people. The reality is, this is well-funded, orchestrated political theater that we're seeing right in front of us.
Yeah, and you know, you talk about the state level, and you know, this is one thing that I think we really do need to remember, is that, you know, as I talked about, you know, these other conservative organs, you know, there's something called ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council. And for decades, they have spent a lot of time, energy, and money on electing Republican legislators to state houses, state senates, and then, you know, statewide office, whether or not it's Secretary of State, attorneys general, governors. And so what you see now, and this is something David Pepper, former Democratic chair of the Ohio party, said, is that it's basically like pay for play isn't the exception, it's the rule. So all of these Republican legislatures, Ohio, Florida, Texas, Iowa, Louisiana, wherever it is, it's the lobbyists, you know, they do two things. They deliver a bill and then they deliver a check. Or maybe they deliver a check and then they deliver a bill. It doesn't matter. The public outcomes are horrendous. They have no bearing on the lives of people. We've seen that in Kansas, where a Democrat won for governor a couple of years ago because public education funding had been cut so deeply that kids were only going to school 4 days a week. And so we can only hope that as we get into yet another election year, that voters are starting to wake up and say, the Republicans have nothing but fear and, you know, retrograde, you know, social wars to fight as we get into this next fight.
Yeah, and that's where your organization comes in, because I think you guys do some of the best messaging out there. The Lincoln Project, you know, during the Trump years was front and center. You know, what is it that you're focusing on in the coming weeks and months? Because clearly the message war, Democrats are losing badly.
So, I mean, what we do, I mean, look, we're all former Republicans, right? Maybe one or two of us have become Democrats, but most of us are independents, and we operate outside, you know, the Democratic, you know, campaign and political superstructure, but generally alongside it, because we believe that the Republican Party must be repudiated by voters in 2022, 2024, probably 2026 and 2028 as well. So what we do is take a Republican view of the world vis-a-vis politics and how you campaign, which is pretty bare knuckle. You know, we don't pull a lot of punches. You know, we are lucky enough that Republicans do enough bad things now that you don't even need to make up or twist their words or their actions. You just reflect them back to voters. And oftentimes, you know, that's enough. But what we also do in these races, you know, there'll be targeted House races, targeted U.S. Senate races, and targeted governor's races this coming year. You have to change the dynamic of a race. And that's what we do. In 2020, what we learned, and I think you'll see this with a lot of these sort of Trumpy candidates, is we put ourselves between Donald Trump and Joe Biden as the Biden campaign was getting its feet underneath it. We will do that where we want the Republican nominee in a given race to turn toward us and fight us on our terms as the Democrat goes and campaigns on the things that they believe are best for their state, for their district, whatever the case might be, and really make sure that, you know, ultimately, yeah, we get a lot of attention for our ads. But really what we want to do is find those Republicans and those independents who are disaffected during the Trump years, right, who are still up for grabs, right? They're not Democrats by nature, but they hate what the Republican Party has become. Right. And what we want to say to them is, this is not the time to argue about policy. This is the time to worry about democracy and decency. Come with us for this cycle, for this candidate. Let's get over this hill, 24, 26, 28. You know, we can go back to arguing about marginal tax rates and parts per billion of what's in the air.
I look forward to that last question. I got it real quick, because ultimately I do want a functional Republican Party. I do think you need to have both. I don't want one that's willing to burn the house down. So is what you're talking about.
Yeah, look, I mean, the Republican Party will not. There are only two ways that the Republican Party will moderate itself in any real way. One is if and when Donald Trump leaves the scene. And two, if he is defeated again, let's say in a 2024, but again, they are defeated writ large in such a way that even the candidates say, well, we can't win like this anymore.
Yeah, well, let's hope that actually happens. But Reid, I appreciate the time.
Where more moderates can try and come back into the play.
I hope it works. I appreciate the time. Keep up the great work. I hope you'll come back and talk to us again real soon.
Thanks, Rick.
Good stuff. Reid Galen, co-founder of the Lincoln Project. We'll get links out on social media how you can take a look at that. Let's take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1897. That was the day that Dorothy Day, a leader of the Catholic worker movement, was born in Brooklyn, New York. As a young girl, her family moved to San Francisco. Her father lost his job as a sports writer due to the devastating earthquake of 1906, and the family relocated again to Chicago. In 1932, she met Peter Morin, and together they founded the Catholic Worker Movement, a faith-based social justice effort. The Catholic workers opened what they called houses of hospitality to serve those in need. Dorothy helped to co-found the Catholic Worker, a monthly newspaper that became a voice for poor and working people. While writing for the paper, Dorothy traveled and visited with some of the most exploited workers in the country. She talked with migrant agricultural workers in California and was arrested for supporting the United Farm Workers in 1973. In 1940, she visited the Hooverville encampment in Seattle, Washington. Dorothy's reporting vividly demonstrated how her faith informed her activism. She wrote, quote, "The rain poured down, underneath was mud, ankle deep, and the long lane that cut between the rows of shacks reflected the gray clouds in its pools. But Christ is there. I thought sadly, there in the mud, in the shacks with his poor, with them he is trying to find a place to lay his head. With them he hungers, and with them he suffers fatigue of body and soul. Behold, O God, our Redeemer, and look upon the face of thy Christ. There in the dumps, among the creatures who still are men, have pity on them and on us who permit such things to be." Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So as I said in the opening, the reality is, I think if you're a Democratic politician, if you're a voter, find a picket line. Find a picket line, find a friend, walk with that person who's on strike, and get that master's class in working class economics. Find out whether, don't talk, don't say a word. Listen. Get out of the silo, get on the picket line, and you know, walk shoulder to shoulder with somebody. To me, that's the advice of this moment. Last week it was what it was. Going forward, we need to reconnect the working class, because as I said, it is the largest multicultural, multiracial, multigender coalition on this planet. All of us have to work. All of us need our paycheck, healthcare, retirement security, all of the things that we get from our jobs, and we need to make those better. And here to share some thoughts on, well, part of the messaging coming out of last week's elections and what we also need to be doing. I've asked my good friend Jeff Hauser to come talk with us. Jeff is the executive director of the Revolving Door Project at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. He's got a new opinion piece out, a message to Democrats ahead of 2022. Make corporations your enemy. Jeff, thanks for taking time for us.
Every time, Rick.
Make corporate America your enemy? Is that the message we're going for right now?
I think people are angry. Working people are angry. There are more strikes than there have been in a long period of time because workers are sick of being taken advantage of. You see a lot of anger about inflation, and Republicans would have you believe that that has something to do with the American Rescue Plan, when in reality, we are seeing price gouging at an extreme level as corporations take advantage of the tumult in the wake of the pandemic. There is price fixing going on. There is systematic underinvestment in basic infrastructure, including at the ports. And there are lots of consequences. There's the meatpacking industry is rife with anti-competitive behavior. I mean, basically just price fixing by meatpackers. You're seeing this up and down the economy. You're seeing consumers angry. You're seeing working people angry. And in the absence of a story coming from the Democratic Party about who's causing this problems, who's causing the problems and how Democrats can fix them, you know, the stories coming from Republicans are going to be more appealing. Some story beats no story.
No, and what they've been doing, blaming the truck drivers, all the truck drivers' fault. So we need automated vehicles. That seems to be the latest moronic answer. No, what you need is we need to hold corporate America, need to hold them accountable. And we need to pay truck drivers better so that more people will go to the jobs. Just a thought.
Yeah, I mean, at the ports, you have the expectation is that truck drivers will wait around on their own dime up and until the congestion there allows them an opportunity to get a load. I mean, that's ridiculous. But it is because corporate America has created this just-in-time system in the economy where there's no resiliency. If any little thing goes wrong, the whole thing breaks down. And honestly, it's kind of amazing we haven't had one of these situations before. There have been isolated examples where, like, all of the saline bags used in hospitals are made in Puerto Rico. And so Puerto Rico has, you know, a hurricane, and there are, like, repercussions for the American healthcare system. So this is not out of nowhere, but at this scale, this is obviously new. There is bad behavior going on. And rather than the public message out of Washington be Biden and Democrats in disarray on legislation, it'd be great that there'd be some storytelling going on about the Biden administration doing something about the problem, finding some of the villains, letting everyone know about them, letting people sink their teeth into a story about corporate greed. Because I think we all know that when there are rapid price increases, corporate greed is at the heart of it.
Absolutely. And look, we saw during the pandemic, from the beginning of the pandemic till now, our 745 certified USDA certified billionaires, they pocketed a cool, what, $2.1 trillion? Because look, they're the ones making out because of this pandemic. And now in your piece, you write, if Democrats refuse to fight for the people will seek fighters elsewhere. This is something I've been saying for, you know, for years. The Democrats will maybe hold your coat in a street fight, but they're not going to ball up their digits and get in there and mix it up. I think right now, more than ever, we need Sherrod Brown's, we need Tim Ryan's, we need people who are going to ball up the digits and get out there and start throwing some punches.
Yeah, and we also need Merrick Garland to actually do his job. I mean, because some of this is that there is illegality going on, and illegality, when you have structural problems in the economy, the illegality is not at the level of the ordinary person. It's at the level of the CEO and the C-suite, the people who run corporate America, that they need to know that the government is watching and is looking to see if any laws or regulations are being broken. And you know, my suspicion is they are. Like, obviously, people are entitled to due process. So if I'm wrong and it all checks out, good, that's good. But I want the transportation department focused on what's going on at the ports. I want to see what's going on. And are trucking companies intentionally not ramping up supply so that they can reap higher benefits that don't go down to the trucker level? But somebody is probably making money off the scarcity of everything, from freight rail to trucking to the ability to get container ships loaded off at docks.
No, I mean, you see it all the time. I mean, there are drivers at the port who are saying, look, there's all these dollies, there's all these containers, there's all this stuff going on, and here are hundreds of rigs just sitting, waiting for something. And this is, you're right, this is, there's something afoot here. And what, well, you know, what the right would have you believe is, well, it's those working people. Because we're in a moment, Jeff, where strikes are happening, where worker militancy is increasing. And the media is eating it all up. I'm waiting for that moment when they flip the script and say, look, the reason all these shortages, the reason the kids can't get G.I. Joe with the Kung Fu grip, it's those workers, Jeff.
I mean, the ironic thing is that Larry Summers, the famous economist and former U.S. Treasury Secretary under Bill Clinton, he has been going around giving the press quotes that they love to use, blaming inflation on Joe Biden, the rescue plan, because he's just sick and tired of not being in office. Like, this is the first Democratic president since Jimmy Carter that he doesn't have a big job working for.
And thank goodness.
Right. And, you know, that's actually, and him being out of a job is one of Revolving Door Project's greatest accomplishments. We're very proud of that. But so he's going around talking about inflation. And the ironic thing is that a lot of what's going on in the American supply chain right now is the globalization of the late 1990s under Bill Clinton. The problems of that are coming home to roost. Like, everything in the world is so complicated to produce. There is so many fractions of pennies being saved by shipping some stuff to China and then from China to Vietnam and to Mexico and to Europe. And it's not that we shouldn't have any trade or we don't want to see working people across the globe do better, but it is such a needlessly complicated system. It also has, you know, climate implications if like everything involves transportation halfway and around and back the world. But the basic idea is America is not self-sufficient in almost anything right now.
Right.
And so if China sneezes, America, like, you know, gets a serious health consequence. And I'm not making a reference to COVID-19. I'm talking about the economy. Like, when a random port in China shuts down, the ripple effects across this country are just extravagantly significant, because we are importing every single basic thing you need. Like, this is not a way to run a modern country.
No, it's not. And it's something that, you know, I've been saying, you know, for a while now, that we need to rebuild our manufacturing. And this is where the bipartisan infrastructure bill, I think, is important, but also the Build Back Better plan and more. I mean, we need a national security level strategic plan to rebuild manufacturing, not just on, you know, PPE and that kind of stuff, and not just military stuff, but just the things that we need each and every day.
I mean, we need to be able to make solar panels at scale in the United States so we can both address climate change and create jobs. Then we also have to have a government that is supportive of workers to make sure that green jobs are actually labor jobs, good jobs, in the way that has been promised in the past. And so there obviously are some difficulties right now where there's, I think it's Rivian is the electric truck manufacturer that's not producing, is not unionized. Like, we need these jobs to be green jobs in America, union jobs, and we need them now. Because right now, you can't even bring solar panels into the country. It's just like so messed up that America is not at the cutting edge of being able to take on the dual crises of our time, economic inequality and climate.
No, I know what we end up doing is we end up going to the polls and voting on some stupid theory that everyone thinks is happening but isn't happening because it's critical about race or whatever that nonsense in Virginia was. And you voted for a guy who was literally a union buster, fired unionized workers just for profit. And you go, this is who you voted for because, well, he hates the same people, I guess. Is that the theory?
Well, I mean, first off, Glenn Youngkin is as bad or worse than what you've said. I mean, I think like the opposition research that was not adequately deployed against Youngkin is amazing. McAuliffe ran a flailing campaign headed up by a retread from the Pete Buttigieg campaign, who has a history of underperforming. And they ran a mess of a campaign, but there were some real difficulties because Carlyle and the rapacious private equity firm that Youngkin ran, he didn't even run it very well. He actually got ran out of Carlyle once he got the big job. He didn't last very long because he was not actually good at being a vampire, which is like, I don't know which would be better if you were good at being a vampire or bad at it. But McAuliffe couldn't go after him hard because McAuliffe had a significant personal investment in Carlyle. Now we have a better governor in New Jersey who's done a pretty good job in Phil Murphy, but he also is himself a Goldman Sachs alum, which, you know, he's done, you know, pretty well in terms of his policies for somebody with that background. But that also further, you know, eroded his ability to tell a populist story. But the basic thing is we need to tell interesting stories. And we're not always going to be able to tell a narrative about the big economic forces in the country, because that is too theoretical. That's too abstract. But what you can do is run the government to identify who are the villains, what are the corporations misbehaving, and then drill down on the examples that are representative of the broader case and are intelligible to people.
Right.
And find the example of, here is a medical manufacturer that is doing this, and here are some kids who are suffering as a consequence, and here are some workers in this plant, and like telling, like going in deep and then figuring out, you know, and he bought a Ferrari, the owner of this company. We go in, tell a story that can be each day you're finding out new stuff. It's being shared on social media. We need to be creating villains. And honestly, we need some villains who are smart enough to punch back. Because you know who has been making no news in the last several months? Mitch McConnell. Mitch McConnell has allowed all the news out of Washington to be Democrats in disarray.
Yep.
Because Democrats are actually talking about popular policies, it is Mitch McConnell's goal to have no conversation about policy. He wants it to be all about process. And then they have the right-wing echo chamber that talks about these crazy cultural issues, these made-up threats to America. So they have a negative story. They have Trump mainlining hate to the far right, while Trump is taken off of Facebook and Twitter and is not being covered by the mainstream media. So normal people don't see Trump. The crazies get a ton of Trump.
Yeah.
McConnell stays out of his own way. And all people hear is these made up stories on the right and Democrats fighting with each other. That is a recipe for continued disaster.
No, I'm right there with you. But here's the interesting thing, and I love your piece about making, you know, corporate America the enemy in this moment, because they are. A lot of the bad stuff is happening there. But I also see Republicans kind of moving in that direction. Marco Rubio and that crowd kind of saying the exact same thing that you're saying, but just from a little bit different perspective.
Yeah, I mean, like the polling is really clear. And if we had a conversation about rapacious greed, that would be good. And there are like constant stories in history about FDR had a war on inflation. FDR ran price controls during which I'm not sure, I'm not saying they can get through in 2021, but he had Harry Truman running a investigation into contracting to supply World War II to make sure that none of the contractors were corrupt and getting illegal, making money that they didn't deserve. And that's why Harry Truman became vice president and ultimately president, was that he was going after corporate greed. He was going after who was excessively raising prices.
Yep.
Even Nixon did this kind of stuff. And that's part of why he got reelected by the margins that he did.
Yeah. Well, the Truman Commission, you're absolutely right. It was one of those things. And I've been calling for that. And I've also been calling for the next TR. Where's the next Teddy Roosevelt? We need a trust buster. We need someone to break up these massive monopolies. Amazon, I'm sorry, too big. We've got to do something about these giant corporations who seem to have so much outweighed power.
And that's, I mean, honestly, that is one of the areas where Biden has excelled and wildly exceeded our expectations. It's just unfortunately a little early. So right now we have as the chair of the Federal Trade Commission, a woman, Lina Khan, who is literally enemy number one for Amazon. There is no person they fear or loathe more than Lina Khan, who, while a law student, wrote one of the most influential articles written by in the area of law in the 21st century about Amazon and its rapaciousness. There is a very strong populist trustbuster that's been nominated and is about to get confirmed to be the head of the antitrust division at the Justice Department. We need another vote on the third member of the Federal Trade Commission to restore democratic control there. But I think we're going to start seeing that. And the funny thing is, Lina Khan got like 26 Republican votes to confirm. I believe Rubio and a bunch of people who I disagree with on almost everything, but they're reading the moment also. And they know that mega large corporations are not popular. And so there is a bipartisan opportunity here. And so hopefully Biden will do everything necessary to keep this going, to empower his trust busters, yep, and then start creating some real violence between the government and the lawbreakers.
There you go. Jeff, I appreciate the time. The piece, A Message to Democrats Ahead of 22, Make a Corporation Your Enemies, written by Jeff Hauser. Jeff's the executive director of the Revolving Door Project there at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. Jeff, as always, appreciate the time, man.
It was good. It was good talking to you.
Good stuff, Jeff Hauser. Let's take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
On June 25th, 1938, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt signed the Fair Labor Standards Act into law. Viewed as one of the final pieces of legislation of FDR's New Deal and the single most worker-friendly piece of legislation ever written, the Fair Labor Standards Act of 1938 was a victory not only for labor unions, but for workers, families, and children across the country. FDR called the new law the most far-reaching, far-sighted program for the benefit of workers ever adopted in this or any other country. This visionary piece of legislation put a ceiling over hours and a floor under wages, mandating a 44-hour work week, a 25-cent minimum wage, and time and a half for overtime. The Fair Labor Standards Act was later amended to 40 hours per week and 40 cents per hour. The law also excluded children from working dangerous jobs and set standard conditions for the employment of child workers to avoid continued exploitation of children. The Fair Labor Standards Act has been changed or amended at least 43 different times. These alterations have been used both to expand worker protections, such as raising the minimum wage, prohibiting age discrimination, and requiring equal pay, and to restrict and take away protections such as the Taft-Hartley Act and the 2004 Fair Pay Amendment. Today, we take the 40-hour work week, minimum wages, overtime, and child labor protections for granted. But up until the passage of the Fair Labor Standards Act, workers were at the mercy of their employers, and children were dying in industrial accidents. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.